Today on Maine Calling, light in wintertime. Do you find yourself seeking or creating light this time of year? Hanging strings of festive holiday lights, lighting candles, waking up for sunrise, or making time to stargaze? We humans crave light, and as we approach the winter solstice, we find magic and joy in the sparkle and glitter and glow of the season. I'm Jennifer Rooks. My colleagues here at Maine Public Classical have produced a holiday special celebrating the magic of winter light. Today on Maine Calling, we find out what they'll share, what music and food in Maine places, and we'll explore the primal human impulse to create art and light in the shortest and darkest days of winter. Maine Calling is just ahead.
Maine Calling is made possible by contributing listeners and support from Rennie's, a Maine shopping adventure throughout Maine, now open in Bangor, Waterville, and Augusta, and by Maine Seacoast Mission, delivering healthcare, education, and support to islands and coastal Downeast communities. Learn more at seacoastmission.org.
I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Yes, winter is cold and dark, but if you look on the bright side, you can think, well, it makes you appreciate light in the darkness. Today, we're going to explore all the reasons and ways that light can make winter a magical time, and we're going to learn how our Maine Public Classical team tapped into the theme of winter light for a special holiday program called Night Lights. Joining me in the studio, two of my colleagues who worked on that special, Sarah Tuttle, who is a Maine Public Classical host and producer, and Jessica Miller, Weekend Edition host, who helped produce Night Lights. Also with us, Dr. Alexander Diamond Stanek, who is an associate professor and chair of physics and astronomy at Bates College. We invite you to join the conversation. What do you do to appreciate winter light? Do you decorate with candles, strings of festive lights? Do you go stargazing? Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, post a comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. Before we learn more specifically about this special, and I'm so excited for you all, congratulations, I want to talk a little bit about this time of year, and Alex, I'm going to turn to you. It is the winter solstice on Sunday, about 10 o'clock in the morning. What does that mean exactly? I think a lot of people know that it's the shortest day of the year, but explain exactly what it means to people like you.
So thank you, Jennifer. So the word solstice literally means sol for sun and stis for stop. So the sun stops. And what does it stop doing as you go through the fall towards the winter? Every day, the sun doesn't get quite as high in the sky as it did the day before. It's not above the horizon for quite as long. So if we recall back on the equinox, it was 12 hours of daylight, 12 hours of sunlight, 12 hours of nighttime. So equinox means equal day, equal night. But slowly since then, we've been progressing where the sun is rising kind of in the southeast rather than due east. And it's inching further to the south every day as we go through the months of October and November and into December. And solstice is when all of that stops, when finally the days start to get a little bit longer again, the sun starts to get a little bit higher in the sky. So strictly speaking, it has to do when the sun gets to a certain position in the sky relative to the background stars. It's sort of the furthest south essentially that it ever gets. But it's really, to me, a sign that the days are going to start getting longer. We're going to start seeing the sun a little bit more. The sun's going to get higher in the sky.
And I understand the Earth is actually the closest to the sun in January. Why is that? How can we be closest to the sun but in this very cold time?
Yeah, so that's an interesting thing connected to Earth's orbit around the sun. So Earth's orbit is pretty close to a circle, but it's actually slightly elongated in an ellipse. And if you are in an ellipse, you sometimes are a little closer, a little further away. It turns out when you're a little bit closer, Earth's a little closer in its orbit, it's actually also moving a little bit faster. So it turns out the reason that we have these changes that lead to something like the solstice, that lead to changes in how high the sun gets in the sky, how long the days are, is actually connected to just the exposure to sunlight that we're getting throughout different seasons. It doesn't have anything really to do with how close we are to the sun. So being closer to the sun is just sort of a coincidence. But if you lived in the southern hemisphere, you'd be like, well, it's actually winter, excuse me, it's actually summer in January rather than winter. And so it's the seasons are connected to the amount of exposure to sunlight that we get, which is related to how high it goes in the sky, and how many hours of sunlight that we get. And so it's an interesting thing that we are sort of maybe winter is actually a little bit shorter, you might think, because we're just moving a little bit faster through this part of the orbit, but it's a pretty subtle effect. But yeah, we are a little bit closer to the sun now than we would be 6 months from now.
And throughout human history, we know that different cultures have marked the winter solstice in different ways. Tell us some that stand out to you, Alex.
There's so many to potentially speak of. I guess I'll just speak to one that's maybe a little bit more sort of connected to my own heritage and identity. So my last name, Diamond Stanić, is really Diamond Stanić, which is a Serbian last name. And the spelling of my first name, Alexander, has a KS in it and an AR at the end, and that's connected to my Serbian grandfather. And there is something called a Slava celebration that, at least for my family, is always very close to the solstice. Actually, it turns out it's today, December the 19th. And so it's not exactly the solstice, but I always sort of think of it as a way to celebrate family and a way to celebrate this sort of thing that all human beings are experiencing that we don't really have control over, but we're just able to to observe and be a part of. And so that's just my own connection on a solstice celebration, which I'm happy to be celebrating today.
So humans throughout human history haven't spent the solstice alone, but together, by coming together.
Yeah, and it's a way, through, of course, it depends exactly where you live, right? If you live at a more northern latitude or a more southern latitude, if you're closer to the poles, the winter solstice is more extreme, right? If we went all the way up to the Arctic Circle, there would be no sunlight at all. And there, if you're far enough north, there hasn't been any sunlight really since September. So that experience of it really, varies based on where you live. If you live at a more sort of a latitude closer to the equator, you have to pay attention a little bit more to even notice that these changes are happening. But for folks who live, at approximately 45 degrees north latitude, it's a really striking thing. And I think coming together in moments of otherwise darkness to bring light, I think is really a strong human thing.
Well, Sarah and Jess, I want to talk about your special night lights. This is the first year you've done this. I'll start with you, Jess. How'd you get the idea? How did the team get the idea?
Well, in the past, Maine Public Classical has made holiday specials, but they've mostly been made in a studio, people talking to people or colleagues or hosts. This year, we wanted to get out around Maine and really bring the feeling of those places and people who celebrate the light and the darkness of winter. And that's exactly what we did. We traveled all around the state. We hung Christmas lights at the Nubble Light. We experienced a moonrise ceremony at Passamaquoddy Bay. And as you listen, you'll really get a sense of what it's like to be in those places with those people doing these rituals.
And of course, you are the Maine Public Classical host. So, Sarah, there's music in the special. Tell us about some of the music. How did you come to decide? I mean, there's a lot of music that it was written about and for this time of year. How did you decide what to include?
Well, what makes this special so special is the orientation towards story. We were able to connect with so many different folks around the state, and it was a real pleasure to be able to select music that is in relationship to the stories being told. So there's a wonderful variety of pieces, some really energetic, some very calm and serene, and it's especially exciting because the special features a number of relatively new releases, like the brass ensemble Sarabanda. They have a Cuban Nutcracker that came out just this year. Several of the hottest string quartets are featured in the music for this special, and there's a variety of not just classical, but folk and jazz and all sorts of things.
Well, we're going to listen to a clip of one of the songs. This celebrates getting out in the snow. It's called Let's Go Sledding. Sarah, what do we need to know about this?
You do need to know that it's by Ken Turley, who is based in Fryeburg, Maine, a local Maine composer in this piece.
Oh, that's lovely. Alex, you were on an earlier Maine Calling show this year that was about Maine light in general and why it appeals to artists and photographers. But now we're specifically talking about winter light in Maine. What sets the winter light apart? Is there a scientific explanation for why it looks the way that it does?
Yeah, I think it's really just connected to the fact that the sun is spending so much of its time pretty low in the sky. And that is sometimes striking. For example, I was driving south towards Portland the other day around noon, and the sun was like right in front of me. And it's like, it's also like bouncing and reflecting off the snow and the ground. So it's sometimes when it's out, I always am very much aware of it because it's sometimes right in your face because it's not as high in the sky. So that's one thing that's different about it. And, you know, the sunrise in the morning, you know, it starts to become a little bit later and later, right? And it sort of takes a little bit more time to get up. So sometimes sunrise can be like, wait, when's it actually going to get light out? And then you notice it and it can be dramatic. And similarly, sunset starts earlier than you're expecting. And all of a sudden it's like, you know, it's 3:30 getting to 4 o'clock and you're like, wait, where'd the sun go? So that difference in terms of the sun being lower in the sky and our experience of it, and in particular how the sun can, say, reflect off the snow, it can still seem pretty bright out if you're actually having that exposure to sun when it is out. But I always try to just notice it and appreciate it in those moments when I am getting this sun exposure, because I know that, you know, pretty soon it's going to be dark again. So that particular piece of the sun being low in the sky is the most sort of dramatic piece of late fall into early winter.
And what about the moonlight in the winter? Does that take on a different quality as well?
Yeah, so the moon, the path of the moon through the sky is similar to the path of the sun through the sky, except that the moon does essentially all of the paths that the sun could take over the course of a year. It does all of them in a month.
Huh.
And so there are times when, you know, in some ways, actually the most dramatic full moon happens around the winter solstice, because on that day, the sun is taking a path where it really doesn't get very high in the sky, and it isn't up for very long, but the moon actually gets super high in the sky and is up for more than 12 hours. So the moon is sometimes, you know, striking when you can see it at night. The moon is also, you know, up during the day. The moon doesn't really care. It's doing its own thing, and it's going through this certain sort of set of phases. But I would say a full moon around winter is often really, really very striking because it's up for so long, and it's coming, typically rising around sunset. And so that also makes it particularly striking.
Well, speaking of a full moon, Jess, you went to a full moon ceremony. And this was a drumming ceremony in Passamaquoddy Bay. Tell me about it.
Yeah, I drove all the way up to Passamaquoddy Bay. You pass the midway point between the equator and the North Pole there. And I arrived at Split Rock, which is a sacred site for Passamaquoddy people. And there I met Lynn Mitchell, who's a Passamaquoddy educator. She works in high schools with a lot of young Passamaquoddy children, but she also runs this drumming circle called the Thunderbird Women. And we stood there with a mix of people of different ages, a lot of the Thunderbird Women, but also young people who are just learning these songs for the first time. And it's a very sensory experience. There are smells and sights. We lit a fire. You take tobacco in your left hand. You say a prayer and you drop it in the fire so that it can rise to your ancestors. There was smudging with sage. And then there was a lot of singing. And the singing was so joyous. You can see everybody just beaming because for a long time, these people were not allowed to perform these ceremonies in public, and now they can. And to see this younger generation kind of adopting these rituals, everybody is just so psyched. It was really special to be there.
I was going to say, it sounds really moving.
Yeah, yeah, it was very powerful. I was so lucky to be invited into the fold there by Lynn. And I know we have a clip of
little
Lynn.
Tiny taste. Yeah, yeah, a little tiny taste of that. Let's hear it.
Oh, here she comes. Oh, look, right there.
She's big.
She is big. Yep. Here she comes. Oh, well, here she is. Yeah, making her appearance. It's like we've been asleep for quite a while, and now these ceremonies are coming back, and we're trying to make it happen.
You're like waking up with the world, you know? Like, you're just this little tiny speck in this whole giant world, but What a magnificent world it is.
Right, so what's going on there is you hear Lin, the moment that the Grandmother Moon made her appearance from behind the clouds. It was cloudy when we first arrived. And at some point, they sang this song called The Trade Song, which you actually hear a little bit of under that music. That's the trade song performed by the great indigenous artist Jeremy Dutcher. And we sang the trade song, and everybody was joking, oh, we'll trade this song for a glance at Grandmother Moon. And then I was standing there the moment it happened. It was very special. And then we also heard another Thunderbird woman there named Jody Sakobason, who described both moonrise ceremonies to me and sunrise ceremonies, which she does privately by the water.
All right. Well, the special that we're talking about, Nightlights, is going to air several times. There's a 3-hour version of it and a 1-hour version of it. And you can find a link to that at Maine Public's website. When is the first chance to catch the special?
It's going to air on Maine Public Radio this Sunday at 1 p.m.
Okay. Sarah, what do you want to add?
So the version you'll hear on Maine Public Radio is the 1-hour story-oriented version. And then we're going to have a longer version available on Maine Public Classical. It's 3 hours long. It has a bit more music for you to enjoy. That will air for the first time at 10 o'clock on Tuesday, the 23rd.
All right, and all of the times on the website. We are going to take a quick break. We're talking about winter light on Maine Calling. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. From the winter solstice to stars and dark skies to holiday lights, it is the season to celebrate light in the darkness. We're doing that by learning about the phenomenon of winter light, and we're also getting a preview of our Maine Public Classical holiday special, Nightlights, which airs several times from December 23rd through the 25th. Joining me today, Bates College Physics and Astronomy and Physics Professor Alex Diamond Stanek, Maine Public's very own classical music host, Sarah Tuttle, and Weekend Edition host, Jess Miller. Both of them worked on this special. We invite you to join the conversation. Do you celebrate the winter solstice? Have you seen the northern lights? Send us an email, talk@mainpublic.org, comment on Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. Joining us now is John Meter, who is an astronomy educator and co-founder of Dark Skies Maine. He owns the Northern Stars Planetarium. Thanks so much for calling in, John.
Hey, Jennifer, it's good to be here. Thanks for having me back again.
For dark skies aficionados, this is not the worst time of the year, is it?
It is not the worst time of the year. For people who like to look at the stars, it's a great time. If you're dressed right, you've got to dress warm because you're going to go out and stand around looking at the sky. But the winter sky is absolutely gorgeous. And the darker spot you are, the more stars you're going to see. It's one of those funny things where you get away from the light so you can see more light. In other words, fainter and fainter light. If you get to a dark spot here in Maine, you know, in the Maine North Woods, or even just out in the countryside away from the towns and cities, you can see a lot more stars than if you're in Portland or even in a town like Waterville or Skowhegan or something. So get out there and bundle up and give your eyes about 15 to 20 minutes to really get dark adapted. It takes that long to get dark adapted. When I leave star parties, I always tell people that we're going to be out here in the dark, and if someone drives in the parking lot across the way, we're all going to be astronomy snobs and turn our backs on them, because glancing at those headlights, because we all want to see who's coming, sets you back, right, almost back to the beginning, and then you get another 10 minutes to get back to where you were. So we try to avoid white lights. If you need a light, a red light is much better for if you want to look at a chart or something, but your eyes get used to the dark, and you can see incredibly faint stars. And you can do it early in the evening this time of year, which is really nice. I did a star party on Vinyl Haven Monday night. We started at 5 p.m.
That's what I was going to say. I think you've told me it's not the shortest day of the year. It's the longest night of the year.
Exactly right. So enjoy that dark sky. You know, in June, I do star parties. They start at 10 p.m. And this time of year, you can start at 5 and get out there and then really enjoy the sky. And then you get back inside and it's 7:30 and you have a cup of hot chocolate or something and warm up and talk about what you've been looking at.
And let me ask you this, not today, obviously, but when it is cold and bright outside and there's a clear sky and the air is dry, it feels like you can see more. Is that the case?
Well, it is. You know, the summer you have those clear nights, but we have a lot of humidity here, and that really makes it difficult to see those faint stars. It makes the stars twinkle a lot more. Stars don't really twinkle. It's our atmosphere that makes them twinkle. So when you get those cold, cold nights in Maine, that also means there's very little humidity in the air. So the stars are going to seem much crisper and sharper, and you'll see fainter and fainter stars.
Well, I know
so
that
there's
the,
definitely a plus.
Yeah, and I know that the aurora borealis isn't really a seasonal thing, but boy, it is romantic to be able to see that when there's snow on the ground and it's a beautiful night. What can you tell us about our chances of seeing the northern lights, the aurora borealis, this winter?
Well, we've had a great run of it for the last year and a half. The aurora goes through an 11-year cycle, which is caused by the sun. They're caused by coronal mass ejections and solar flares shooting off charged particles towards the Earth, and they're interacting with the atmosphere of the Earth and making the air glow. We're past the peak of that, but there's still a good chance of seeing northern lights. It's funny because people always associate them with the wintertime, and they can happen any time of the year. I think we associate them with winter because we're out after dark more in the winter. You know, it gets dark by 4:30. And so you find just coming home from work, it's dark out, and you might notice them more often. Whereas if it's happening in July and it doesn't get dark enough to see them until 10:30, most people are kind of settled in at that point. So they very well could be happening anytime this winter. You've got to watch what's happening on the sun, and there are websites you can go to. There's one called auroraforecast.com, I believe, and there's another one, spaceweather.com. If you Google those, you can find them, and they'll give you forecasts of what's happening on the sun and the likelihood of northern lights.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. That's John Meter, an astronomy educator with Dark Skies Maine and the Northern Stars Planetarium. Alex, before we move on, anything you'd like to add about the aurora borealis?
Yeah, that it's, I mean, similar to John's point that, you know, it can happen any time of the year. We've been really lucky to be near a solar maximum this past year or so. And certainly, I think a lot of folks saw the Northern Lights last spring. It was really dramatic, really all over the place, but including in Maine. And that point about, you know, that John made, that I think people just tend to look up a little bit more this time of year. Like when your star party, like you said, can start at 5 p.m. instead of 10 p.m. That's a time when you're sort of used to be doing things in your routine and you look up and you notice things. And so I think that's sort of a great way to get people thinking about the stars, thinking about astronomy, thinking about, you know, our place in the cosmos. Because when you have to wait until you're sort of so tired to see the stars, you're a little bit less likely to get out there. And as someone who sometimes gets time allocated on telescopes around the world, when you get a night in December, you can actually collect a lot more data because there's a lot of time between when it gets dark after sunset and then when it gets bright again in the morning. So I think that's again the unique thing about the winter. We're in the dark more often.
So for astronomers, this is the best time of the year.
It can be for collecting lots of data.
Okay. Well, Jess, earlier we heard about your postcard from Passamaquoddy Bay. You also headed pretty far south to Nubble Light. Tell us about that experience.
Yeah, at the Nubble Light, I was lucky enough to meet Matt Rosenberg, who's the keeper of the Nubble Light. He is like a local celebrity who pulls up in his little rowboat on the shore and everybody kind of like perks up and says, oh my gosh, somebody's coming out here. And, you know, I got right in that rowboat. He loaned me a pair of boots because the tide was abnormally high that day. We rowed out to the Nubble, and then he got to take me all around. We went up in the tower. We went down in the basement. And he even let me turn the Christmas lights on myself, which I think maybe we have a clip of.
Yes, let's hear it.
So we're going to go in the basement here.
Okay.
Where the master switch is for the Christmas lights.
The first thing I learned about being a lighthouse keeper is you have to be good at stairs.
Watch your step.
There are a lot of them here.
So it's this little switch right here, and just push it all the way up with your thumbnail. There it goes, lights are on.
Oh, there they are.
Well, look at you.
Yeah, as simple as that. But then what happened was we got up to the ground level, and we started to look at how the lights fared over the year. So the secret is that the lights stay on the lighthouse all year round. And around the fall, Matt has to go around and see what broke.
Oh my gosh.
And fix them in time for Christmas, because there's a lot riding on those Christmas lights. People really love that lighthouse in winter.
Oh yeah, and people love to take pictures of them, especially when there's a full moon in just the right position.
That's
I've seen some spectacular photos. Well, speaking of lights, we are on the line now with Pandora LaCase, who is the sculptural artist who creates the holiday light displays in downtown Portland. Thanks so much for joining us, Pandora.
Hi. Hi, Jennifer. How are you?
I'm great. And I have to tell you that your light displays are one of my very favorite things about Portland. I cannot wait to see them go on every season. How did you come up with, I think so many people may, I don't want to say take them for granted, but be used to them. But way back when you started this project, how did you come up with the idea of creating these organic shapes that look more like light sculptures?
Well, it started in 1999 when Barbara Hager, who was then the director of the Portland Downtown, asked me if I would do something in Tommy's Park. She said that it was, you know, it's the heart of the Old Port area, and it's a little pocket park. And she said it was really very dark down there, and she asked me if I worked in lights. And I said, well, I don't generally work in lights. My medium mostly is metals and wood and plexiglass. But I told her I would give it a try. And so it all started with Tommy's Park. But what I do when I first started Tommy's Park, I went down to see, okay, well, what is in Tommy's Park, and you know, and what happens there, and what are the amenities, and what's the space like? And so when I went down there, I noticed, you know, and I take pictures and I take my time, you know, figuring out what I'm going to do. But I noticed that there were really some tall trees. There were four of them, actually, and they were about 45-foot trees. And I watched people go through the park, and they just walk really quickly by, and they're on their they have a purpose, and they, you know, they're going down the street. And I noticed nobody actually looks up into the canopies of the trees. And in summertime, you see the trees are all have leaves on them and stuff. But I thought the canopy was very wondrous. And so I used the traditional lighting that people use, you know, the Christmas lights. But I went up and I wanted to have these trees, you know, lit in a way where they were talking to each other also, especially as it gets up in the canopy. So I choose limbs that have that interaction with each other. And they, you know, and so I try to capture that type of thing. And it really drew people down to Tommy's Park to see, you know, to see what I had done. And so Portland Downtown, you know, they asked me. So after that, we started doing other sites, and it's grown every year. And after a few years, people along the street, some like Mecca and PMA, asked me if I would do something for them. And then the friends groups like Deering Oaks and Pringle asked me to do some, you know, to create something for them down there. So I have, you know, just eight installations that I do with PD, and then I have eight more that I do with other people, but they're all in the public realm. And that is really what the highlight is for me, is that everybody can enjoy them. They can walk around. They don't have to go into a building. You know, and it's right on the street, it's right in the public space.
Now, I know there's no way one person can do this. Tell us about the effort. What goes into, what kind of helpers do you have? When does it start? Just tell us the inside scoop on how this happens, Pandora.
Okay. All right. Well, every installation is very different. It's all site specific. So I do that whole same thing of going in and designing and creating, you know, what am I going to do? And once I get that done, then we start building, because we build everything, and that's my crew. My husband helps me. My son has helped me in the past, and then I needed a crew to help install. But in the beginning, it was just me and my husband putting Tommy's Park together. But now I've, you know, now I have a little few more crew that come and help, you know, do the repairs and things like that. But we design everything. I design everything and we fabricate in my studio. Some pieces I fabricate outside if they're really much larger than I can handle. But the basic forms I do myself. And I just choose, you know, because it's all about, you know, everything is very, very different. So, you know, are they on trees or are they on buildings or are they on poles? So everything needs to, and luckily my husband's an engineer, so he can help me with some of the technical issues. And some of them are computerized, and he works on that also. So, yes, so it's a big effort. And I have had in the past many people work, come and go, that have helped me, you know, get it all done and get it all together.
It's so interesting to me, Pandora, that you didn't start as a light sculptural artist, that you were a different kind of sculptor, and that you, in some ways this becomes your legacy. And I'm wondering how, if there are even words to describe how it feels to have been able to make an impact on so many people, or do you even have a sense of how many people feel so deeply about the lights that you create?
Well, I hear from lots of people, so I do understand what the impact is. And it's, you know, to be able to work in the public and to be able to work in a community, and I go other places also, but to work in a community that you live in and have people, you know you and come up to you and give them, you know, they tell me their stories. Sometimes when they have guests up, they take them all around to see everything. They tell me which ones they're special, that they like the best. And even children come up to me, you know, when they know who I am, and they come up and they say, you know, they talk to me about what they like and what they don't like. It's really, and I had one person that came up and said her and her husband moved up here because they saw that this was a city who advocates art, you know, so who, you know, it's for artists, you know, artists to move here, and there's a lot going on. So, yeah, so it's been, it's wonderful, actually. And the other thing that really happens, too, is that I know a lot of the people who work in the city, and I've had many people, you know, some of the engineers, some of the traffic, and Jeff Tolling, when he was here, the parks are still very much involved. So it's been such a collaboration in the sense that, you know, they put the white lights up and I put the color lights up. But, you know, the communication just goes back and forth.
Well, Pandora, thank you so much for calling in today. Pandora LaCase, the artist behind those amazing sculptural holiday light displays in Portland. I'm going to go to a caller, David in Elliott. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Yeah, hi. I was just, you were asking earlier if anyone is celebrating the solstice, and my wife and I are having 100 people over tomorrow for the solstice. Just a couple bonfires. We have a sauna. You can dip down in the Piscataqua River and just, yeah, celebrate the longest night of the year, and looking forward to, like, days growing longer, moving to the new year.
I love that you called, David, and that bonfire is one kind of light that we haven't talked about yet. And then Shanna on Facebook also said, we celebrate the solstice with a bonfire. Gathering around a fire with friends not only fosters connection with people we know, but feels like we are connecting with people back through time who have also gathered for the solstice. So isn't that interesting? Two of you, the kind of light. So next year you all have to do a bonfire.
Yeah, perhaps. I mean, I'm a Hanukkah celebrator. So one thing that's nice about Hanukkah is that every night you get a little bit more fire, a little bit more light as you progress through the holiday. And it kind of escalates to that last night when all the candles are lit.
Well, David, thank you for calling. We'd love to have others share what they do for this time of year to celebrate the winter solstice. Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566, and also our email address, talk@mainepublic.org. We'll be right back. Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. We are talking about the magic and wonder of light in winter and how our Maine Public Classical team has put together a holiday program around that theme. With me, Maine Public's Jess Miller. She is host of Weekend Edition. And Sarah Tuttle, Maine Public Classical host. Both work together on this special. Also with us, Dr. Alex Diamond Stanek with Bates College's Department of Astronomy and Physics. You have time if you're quick to send us an email, talk@mainepublic.org. You can also post on Facebook or Instagram or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. An email here from Margaret. I didn't hear it mentioned that the seasons are due to the tilt of the Earth's axis. It's not due to the distance from the sun in elliptical orbit, but due to the Earth being tilted on its axis. So in winter, the slanted angle of sunlight hitting our hemisphere causes the sun's light to be less direct, so less warming, even though we are closer to sun at this time. Alex.
Yes, that's totally correct. That if you think about it right now, you could go to a place on Earth that's, you know, about to experience the summer solstice, right? Where it's really hot and the days are really long and the sun's getting high in the sky. The amount of energy that the Earth receives from the sun is pretty close to exactly constant throughout the year. It's just that that energy gets distributed differently across the globe, depending on where you are. So if you're in, you know, the hemisphere that's tilted towards the sun, you get more light exposure. If you're in the hemisphere tilted away from the sun, you get less. And so, you know, if we were on a more extreme orbit where we got a lot closer or a lot further away, then we might have to worry about the impact of getting closer or further away from the sun. But in practice, we're close enough to to a circle in our elliptical orbit that is really a really small variation.
Does our elliptical orbit change in a million years? Will it be the same as it is right now?
Yeah, so there's, you know, lots of folks who are sort of interested in that, sort of this sort of long-term variations in Earth's orbit. And it seems likely that there have been times when maybe the Earth was tilted a little differently, or maybe we got a little closer, a little further away. There's folks who talk about, is that connected to, and again, this is not my area of research, but is that connected to when certain ice ages happened or not? But at least for now, on the timescale that you are alive, our distance from the sun is really not changing very much at all.
Okay. Sarah and Jess, I know just a minute ago, Jess, you were talking about Hanukkah, and you do some cooking as part of the Northlight special, and the connection to Hanukkah included some traditions that cross cultural boundaries. So tell us about that, Sarah.
Well, I did not grow up in a Jewish household and wasn't exposed to Jewish traditions really growing up, so I was really, really excited to get a chance to make a trip to Brunswick with Jess, where I got to make latkes with a couple of lovely folks, Margaret and Andrew. Margaret is the author of a cookbook called Sabor Judío, and it highlights Mexican-Jewish recipes, and we learned a great deal about that heritage while we made some really tasty latkes.
All right, and we have a clip of that.
You go to some eat somebody's nasty latkes, it's because they didn't want to put any oil in their pan.
The miraculous
Don't
oil.
Don't be stingy with your oil.
Yeah.
Do you want me to keep
flipping? No, let them go. Just wait.
And I got to conquer my fear of frying in the home.
You cannot mess it up. It's okay.
I don't know.
As the latkes sizzled,
the mole is ready.
Margaret started making up some plates.
It's smelling so delicious in here.
All right. Going in. Oh, my God. Wow.
Uh-huh. What are you tasting?
Definitely chocolate up front, then a lot of smoky pepper, little hint of onion,
mm-hmm.
and toasty potato.
Amazing. Do you taste the saltiness of the cheese?
I think I need another bite.
I think so.
I think I need another bite. Jess, did you get to sample as well?
I did. They were fantastic. And you also heard from Andrew Lardy. That's Margaret Boyle's husband in that clip. You know, I grew up Jewish, but I didn't grow up in a Mexican Jewish tradition. And it was really special to spend time with Andrew and Margaret, who described that background. There's a big part of the Jewish diaspora that migrated through Spain or South or Central America. And Margaret's family is one of them. They came through Mexico. She grew up in LA And we may have another clip, I'm not sure, of her. She didn't speak that much Spanish growing up, but she had a grandmother who was very good at cooking and who didn't speak a lot of English, and their shared language was cooking together, and that's how she remembers her, and when she makes these latkes, that's who she's thinking of.
Okay, so are you going to be doing more frying now?
I think so. I have a very tiny apartment, so frying becomes a really big, messy project in my space, but I certainly won't be afraid of frying potatoes in the future.
Okay, well, speaking of multicultural celebrations, let's take this chance to hear one of the other songs featured in the music special. Tell us how Cuban musical traditions meet a Christmas ballet favorite.
Well, this selection comes from a really beautiful recent release put together by the French horn soloist Sarah Willis and her brass ensemble Sarah Band. It's a Nutcracker, Tchaikovsky's Nutcracker with a Cuban twist.
All right, and we dare anybody to not dance when they hear that on the air. Thanks for that. This is so fun. We're going to go now to Patty in Portland. Hi, Patty. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Because I tuned in kind of late, I'm not sure what else you've talked about, but hearing Pandora's stories and experience, amazing. But art is, and light and dark and light in Maine is everywhere. And John Cariani's new play that was put on at Portland Stage last year, I think during the course of it, he named the play The Darker the Night, the Brighter the Stars. And it's all about young people growing up in Presque Isle, and it's all outside and them experiencing the night sky and the challenges they have, but also that gift they have of the Maine sky at night.
Patty, I'm so glad you mentioned that. I saw the play, so exciting and such a perfect artist to mention, John Cariani, because the sky plays such an important part in his plays. So I really appreciate you calling in.
Yeah, we talked to some dark sky preservationists as part of the special, and we discussed, Sarah and I even have discussed how the darkest special in Maine. There are somehow more stars here, more dark skies. And some of our dark sky preservationists that we speak to say that some conversations with your friends or fellow sky observers can only happen in the dark because it gives you that feeling of wonder of being this little small speck in a big universe.
Well, as someone who moved to Maine when she was 10, I know, Jess, you're also not a native Mainer. It was one of the first things that we noticed when we began to call Maine home is there was something really special about being able to see the stars. I came from a much more urban setting. Jess, I think you did as well. And one of the first things that strikes you is that clarity and that sparkle that you get to see in the sky.
Well, I have to ask you about that, Alex. Is that your experience of coming to Maine?
I would say that I lived in a variety of different places, in urban, rural, et cetera, and that the most spectacular skies that I've been able to see have actually been at observatories around the world in Chile and Hawaii, and et cetera. But I would say Maine on a dark location measures up pretty well, particularly for just sort of visible sky observing, just sort of going out and being in the darkness. I think that the challenge sometimes is the temperature, bundling up so you're not freezing cold. But yeah, I think that aspect of Maine in terms of its rural location, being able to get, at least where I live near Lewiston, I'm really, it's not too hard to get out to a place that's really very dark. And that experience of being in a really dark site and just sort of seeing the Milky Way, seeing all the stars that you can see without a telescope, or if you do have a telescope, it's even that more exciting, or even a pair of binoculars can be really great.
It's funny when we you're talking about the temperature, because Patty's talking about John Cariani's work and his play Almost Maine. One of the running jokes in it is maybe not a joke, but the people keep talking about what a great night it is because it's 30 degrees, like one of those amazing right. nights in winter when it's 30 degrees, as if you're talking about it being 75 degrees or something like that. So I love that. I want to ask you, we were talking, I think John Meter was talking about this a little bit earlier, Alex, the idea of stars twinkling. You know, it's so romantic to talk about the twinkling stars, but he says stars don't twinkle. Why do we think that they do?
Yeah, so it's, again, like John said, it's an atmospheric effect. It's basically connected to turbulence in our atmosphere. And so when something, you might notice when something's bright and relatively low on the horizon, it seems to be twinkling. And that's really related to the fact that you actually get even, the light passes through even a little bit more atmosphere to get to you when it's low in the sky compared to when it's high in the sky. And so, yeah, if it's more humid, if the skies or the atmosphere is just turbulent for some reason, you'll get more of that twinkling effect. But in general, for the best observations of planets and stars and galaxies, you want to get to a location where there's less twinkling because it's actually degrading essentially the image quality that you would get if you're trying to get a really sharp image of something. And so yeah, that phenomenon of our atmosphere is something that lots of us have noticed. Depending on your thinking, it could be a really wonderful thing because it's beautiful, or it could be a not so wonderful thing because it's meaning the quality of the data you're trying to collect is not quite as good.
We just have a few minutes left, and I'm wondering, Sarah and Jess, if in doing this special there were any surprises or any moments you didn't expect and you reflect upon now that the whole project is taken care of and and ready to go?
Well, this is definitely a different sort of special than we've offered on Maine Public Classical in the past, so it was really wonderful to be able to dive into story and to connect with more Mainers outside of our Maine Public family in this project. So I was really surprised by the tenderness of the experience, the ability to have that one-on-one connection with folks, to hear their stories. It got very personal at times, very spiritual, and I don't know, it was especially rewarding to be able to see that interplay between music and story as the project has come together.
And what about for you, Jess? What were your surprises or best moments?
I just feel I've fallen deeper in love with Maine. It was such a special experience to travel around and see all these places and meet all these people. And even in the process on the road, driving down east through the autumn blueberry fields turning red everywhere, stopping for tacos down east. You know, I feel like I know this place a little bit better now that I've seen everything.
Yeah, one of my greatest privileges of this job is that I've been to every county. And, nice. And there's still, but you know, still after 31 years, a couple things that I haven't done yet that I have to do, you know. And so are you already planning next year's project?
In my mind, but not on paper.
Well, even some of the ideas that we've heard from folks today have my ideas percolating
too.
Cool ideas already.
Yeah. Well, and I'll turn to you, Alex. Big day today because you're celebrating with friends and colleagues. What does light mean to you this time of year?
I think it's something that I hold dear just because it's something that you don't get as much of. And so when I do see the sun, when it's bright, you know, low in the horizon, reflecting off the snow, I just try to take it in and appreciate it and, look forward to the days starting to get longer.
Well, thank you all so much. Here's an email from Steve. Let's remember that one of the most personal forms of light any time of the year, but especially the winter, is a big, honest smile. Well, thank you, Steve, for that. And thank you to Dr. Alexander Diamond Stanek, Associate Professor and Chair of Physics and Astronomy at Bates College, Sarah Tuttle, Maine Public Classical host and producer, and Jessica Miller, Weekend Edition host. Today's sound engineer was Jane Donahue. Our theme song, which we are not going to hear at the end of this program because we have something special for you, but our theme song you usually hear was composed by Mike Jandro. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. This is Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio. Before we go, we are going to hear a peaceful song from the Nightlight special. It's called By Light. Sarah, what do we need to know about this?
This is a wonderfully intimate performance from pianist Sophie Hutchings.
Okay.
Perfect till that.
I think we got our clips backwards. And Sarah, what do you want to tell us about what we just heard and what we're going to hear next?
Well, that was a beautiful rendition of I Saw Three Ships Come Sailing In. Next, I think we can enjoy that piece by Sophie Hutchings.